Ah, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Welcome to an all-new episode of Surf Splendor. I'm your host, David Scales. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for all the feedback from our last episode, Anatomy of a Surf Trip, documenting my involvement on a surf trip down to Bocas del Toro in Panama. The feedback's been really positive. It was a little bit more of an experimental format for the show. But honestly, it is what I enjoy in podcasts. I listen to a lot of radio documentaries that are really just storytelling, that have nothing to do with surfing. And part of my ambition with Surf Splendor was to produce content similar to that. And it's a lot of pre-production work and a lot of post-production work, and that's why I really hadn't gotten around to it until recently. But I'm pretty happy with the results, and I'm more happy with just the feedback that you've given based on that episode. So hopefully we will be able to do more episodes like it. But considering that we don't have a staff to help produce content like that, they will be a little bit more fewer and farther between than these other episodes. So thanks. Keep the feedback coming. You know you can get a hold of me at surfsplendorpodcast.com. And on social media at Surf Splendor on Instagram and Twitter, and then, of course, on Facebook as well. So reach out there. Keep this conversation going. Today's episode, we're going to bring you a week in This Week in Surf News, again with my co-host, Scott Bass of Down the Line Radio. But before Scott and I actually get into our conversation, which mainly consists of kind of the new ASP and what's going on with the contest that's currently taking place on the Gold Coast and this amazing women's Roxy Pro that we've been watching the last couple of days. Before we get into that stuff, we have a really, really great opportunity to hear from a local San Diego surfer named Johnny Kessel, who just survived this incredibly harrowing experience on this past Sunday, just 3 days ago, during massive storm swell, kind of double to triple overhead surf that we've had here in Southern California. And the story involves sharks and being lost at sea, and even Rob Machado makes an appearance. So not to give away too much, but really amazing, amazing story. And we're really, really glad that Johnny had the wherewithal, the training, and the calmness of mind in the scenario to survive it. So glad you're here, Johnny, and enjoy his story. And then we'll just roll straight into surf news with Scott Bass. So thanks for listening. I'll be back at the end of the show to close us out. Thanks.
He doesn't like the all. No, he loves the all.
I do.
He loves the all.
I just
brother.
Like razzing about it.
Hey, Down the Line Surf Talk Radio. Scott Bass and David Lee Scales with you here on this Tuesday, March the 4th. And boy, a lot of stuff going on in the surf world in 2014, early on here. Not the least of which was this crazy storm and big swell that we had. And so before David and I get into the guts of the week in surf, including the Roxy Pro and the Quicksilver Pro and all of the happenings around what's going on in Australia. We had Big Surf here, and we want to talk a little bit about the Big Surf we had here in California, Southern California, all of California. And part of that was this crazy story that happened here in San Diego regarding a paddler. And we're lucky enough to have this open ocean downwind paddler with us. His name is Johnny Kessel. And Johnny, you're going to, if you would please tell us a little bit about, you know, what your story and what happened to you. So I'll turn this music down.
Yeah, and I was just going to say.
Want to get closer? Can you?
Yes, start from the beginning too, because I read the thing that was posted or that Scott posted on Facebook. But what was the, like, were you just going for a normal paddle? Were you training for something? What were the conditions like? Where do we start?
So basically the premise is that when the south wind blows, everybody starts frothing. Because in San Diego, we just do not get, like, this good downwind conditions.
Gotcha.
So the traditional, like, North County paddler crew will go run up to...
No, but it works better, Johnny, if you just talk at the computer. Don't talk at him.
Okay.
So the North County paddler crew, generally what we'll do is we'll all go up together up into La Jolla and then do a run all the way from... like the top of La Jolla all the way down to Cardiff, or we'll just go to Torrey Pines, depending on the angle of the wind.
How far is that for people who are...
So Torrey Pines is around a 6-mile paddle, and then it's more in the closer to range of like 10, 11 when you go up into Cardiff.
Okay.
So, but when you're going downwind, obviously you're going faster. So,
right.
You know, longer distances are less strenuous. It's actually more about just having a great time, really, than training for anything.
Gotcha.
You know.
So this is Friday, and you and a bunch of guys are getting ready to do this crazy downwind paddle. We've got 30-knot winds at our back, and it's rare here in San Diego, as you mentioned, to have this south wind like this. So it's like, hey, let's get on it. This is unreal. Conditions don't normally come together, and these conditions came together. You can see how I'm spiking here in volume, so make sure that you speak at the same volume that I do. Okay. Don't be afraid to let it go.
All right.
And then what were the swell conditions, too? Were pretty big that weekend, right?
Yeah.
This was Friday, right?
Yep. Right.
Yeah, we've had some wind swell the day before that was kind of a mixed up swell. So we had that residual bump in the ocean, which, you know, in general, we would think that that may be actually a good thing. Because, I mean, if you think about riding bumps out in the open ocean, you want to have something to ride. So,
sure.
So the stronger the wind, the more dramatic it is, the better off you are. Obviously, the more challenging it is. So, you know, there's a certain segment of our crew that like to do downwind paddling, and so we just go and do it. And, you know, most of the guys are kind of very experienced paddlers, have done like the Molokaʻi Oʻahu paddle multiple times, have done like the Catalina Classic multiple times. So I'm kind of coming in behind them and kind of learning from them. So,
well, why don't we talk a little bit about that crew? Because there's George Plasek, who's who's like an iconic paddling figure here in North San Diego County and throughout the paddling community worldwide. Then we had Rob Machado, who's obviously, everyone knows who Rob Machado is, but they might not know that he's a great paddler. And he's an enthusiastic paddler.
Right.
He's a guy that does this a lot. I've done downwind paddles with Rob in Hawaii. He's heavily involved with his very good friend Brian Szymanski, who builds these boards, who's also a 2-time Catalina Classic paddler who was on this mission on Friday as well. Then there's a couple of other stand-up paddle guys that I don't know that are like European icons.
Yeah, European guys, good sup races, etc. And they just showed up kind of...
You just ran into them.
We just ran into them. Right. We weren't actually going paddling with them. It was basically us and a couple of the crew had jumped out at Torrey Pines and gone run through the surf.
Okay.
And we looked at that. It was intense. Like,
yeah.
It was a mess over there. And so we just decided not the clean entry we were looking for. So we ran up to La Jolla, tried to get in at the cove, but were blocked by the lifeguards. And then kind of scooted around the back and suited up. And that's when I made the decision whether I was going to wear a leash or not. That's really what it came down to. So,
do people typically wear a leash?
On a stand-up paddleboard, you're most likely going to find people that are going to wear a leash. And
okay.
The reason why is because they're not as obtrusive as they are if you're on a prone board.
Like,
because proning, you're paddling like a surfboard, and then you're getting up on your knees, and then you're getting back down and you're prone. I mean, it tends to get wrapped around your legs, and it's just a pain in the butt. And as a rule, for the most part, particularly the older boards, and I was on an older board, do not even have leash plugs in them.
Okay.
So the decision I made was either attach a leash to the front, to the bottle cage, or just go without. And I was looking at the conditions, and quite frankly, they look pretty buttery. So initially, I was like, no worries. My major concern was to be able to keep up with them. That's really what was going through my brain at the time. More like, oh, it's a gnarly, gnarly condition. Because if you look at the pictures on the blog, the in the beginning of the panel, the conditions look great.
Yeah.
Kind of mellow.
Yeah.
You know, actually, it just, you know.
Once you got outside the kelp, things changed.
Once you got
outside
the kelp and into the wind line, like all kinds of things started coming in unbuttoned, you know. And So there's four of you.
Yeah. And you're all prone paddlers, and you're about to enter the water, but you run into some lifeguards, right? What happens there?
So this guy comes out of the blue, basically. The lifeguards blocked us at the cove.
Okay.
Now we're going around the corner, and we're going to sneak through this little slot in between the rocks over there. And he comes out of his truck, and he says, well, I'm sorry. He kind of looked a little dejected, actually. He was, like, almost sad to try and stop us from doing it, because, you know, he looked at us, he saw Rob.
That's
he
what I was going to say. That's what
Rob,
I was going to say.
Right?
As soon as he saw Rob,
he
was shit,
like, okay, you guys are legit. All right, okay, just go ahead and do it. And okay, and we ran down the beach, and we just jumped in and went through the dry headed, basically. It was really cool.
Wow.
So we start the paddle, and everything's great. We've got this routine that we have, like every 5 minutes or so, we start regrouping. Because when you're out there paddling and you're catching these bumps, it's not like a routine paddle where you're kind of staying together and chatting and, you know, you may be like fully aware of everybody. When you're riding bumps, you actually, it's as if you're surfing out in the open ocean.
Hmm.
So you
can
be behind
easily,
somebody.
Yeah, 1,500 yards, boom, like that, just by catching one bump and you're off and your guys. So there's a 50 to 100 yard give and take constantly. And then you add to Johnny's situation that you've got three guys that ride bumps really well.
Yep.
And a guy like myself or Johnny, maybe not as good as picking up the bump. So we're naturally going to be left behind. And the general, what all these paddlers do all the time is wait for everyone to kind of catch up and then you go again.
Every 5 minutes
or
so.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And it's...
Am I interrupting enough?
No, not at all. I'm good at it.
I'm trying to keep it condensed.
Yeah, yeah. So it's logical. It's kind of, it makes sense. It's just the way it's been done for. But these guys have been paddling for a long time. Since I've been doing it for the last 4 or 5 years, it's just this is how it gets done.
Gotcha.
So I've never, it wasn't even an issue. So we're getting closer to Scripps Pier and the conditions are starting to get like pretty severe. Like, you know, I'm from South Africa and I was in the Navy and I did a lot of like ocean stuff and this was blowing hard. It was blowing hard. Like to the point where the last stop that I made with Brian was... I think we should paddle closer to the shore, is what he said to me.
How far were you from shore?
At least a mile.
So can you see land?
You could just barely see the outline of the cliffs.
Okay.
So you're as the crow flies, I'm probably, if I had to go with the swell, I'm a few miles at least to get to shore, right?
But gotcha.
Directly off the coast, I'm about a mile, mile and a half.
Sure.
It's hard to tell.
But you can tell what direction the coast is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could still see the coast. And we were concerned that it was going to go completely white out.
Right.
Because you turned around and you were getting water blasted as if somebody had a water cannon. I mean,
oh,
it was
wow.
just
yeah.
Like, it was white. You could see, like, you know, storms that you see out in there. I mean, this is what it was like. It was gusting to, like, 50 miles an hour and plus.
Wow.
So it was insane. So, Brian, I never see a concerned look on his face. And he had a concerned look. And he's normally extremely patient, like, anybody who's paddling with him, he's always very attentive to, like, where you're at and all that. But in conditions like this, it's if they're out there to have fun, you got to go catch some bum.
Yeah.
You know, we just assume that we're going to find each other. So then it happened.
So plot point number two.
Mm.
It happened. What's it?
So you're by yourself.
I'm by myself. I don't see them. They kind of running off. Ran off a little bit. Rob was actually a little bit further out than I was at the time, and I see him come flying down on a bump and then disappear into the haze, basically is what happened. And then I get rolled, basically a side chop comes And I try to catch it, and I get rolled over. And prone paddleboards, they're narrow, and they marginally unstable. This just happened to be a fairly stable one, but from a just a general standpoint, like
relative to a surfboard, they're very tippy.
Yeah, they'll just when I first got on them, and I've been surfing for a long time, though, I just flipped right off them, even on my stomach. So it's easy for you to flip right off. Well, I rolled, got back on, paddled a bit, rolled again, got back on. At this point in time, those guys had taken off, right? Because no one fell. I was the only one falling. And when you fall, it takes you 10 or 15 or 20 seconds to, like, recoup, you know, get back on your board, start paddling again, and you fall again, and you drop another 20 seconds or so back. And then I'm suddenly lifted up. The tail of my board gets lifted up, and I literally get pile driven into the water, like, past my bottle cage, which is on the front, all the way to the center, and get flipped over. So I go pitch poling like a sailboat. And just from the fact that my board had, you know, buried the nose into the water, it got flipped over. And so by the time I got up, I couldn't hold on to it. And by the time I got up, it had, it was about 10 feet away from me.
So it kind of caught, the wind caught it essentially when it went upright?
Yeah.
And blew it?
Also the fact that it sprung.
Yeah, yeah.
Off the, you know, sometimes you'll lose your surfboard, the same thing will happen, or kind of spring away, and then you have to go and get it, right? So in this case, no leash, it's 10 feet away, so I immediately start stroking after it, and it immediately gets picked up by the wind, and because of its shape, it's kind of rounded, and it turned sideways to the wind and just started spinning.
No.
Basically like a barrel, it just rolled away and then went airborne as it hit a bump and just started spinning in midair and just was... I was like, this thing weighs 30 pounds. This is not like Brian Schabansky's on this hollow NCP, you know, stock race.
State of the art, super light. Like, yeah, super this board's light. Older and heavier, and it's gone. It's tumbleweeding, and it's see you later. It's in midair, and it's gone. 50 mile an hour gust taking it. And you're sitting there, Johnny, and what's going through your mind now? You don't have a board. You're lost. You're not lost at sea, but you're at sea by yourself,
right?
With just you and your conscience.
So I'm reliving it right now, actually.
Yeah.
So it's like I'm sitting in the water. I've got my initial reaction is like expletive. I'm in trouble, basically. Yeah. Right. That's my initial thought. And so I start to weigh up all the various options. I'm looking around me, and it doesn't look good. I look towards the shore. It doesn't look good. I'm looking at my board going away, and okay. So I decide immediately that I'm not going off of my board. The four strokes, the five strokes, the sprints that I took to try and go after my board already elevated my heart rate to such a point where I was already starting to feel like if I continue to do this, like it's going to take me a while to recover. And last thing I want is for your heart rate to be elevated like that for an extended period of time, because that's when you start gulping water and like everything just goes south from there. So in... I've been, you know, in the point where I was starting to be very concerned, and obviously I decided that I need to see, and hopefully that board will come flying by Brian or Rob, and they'll see it cartwheeling by, and then they'll grab it, and Rob will dump his stand-up and get on the prone board and paddle it back upwind, because, you know, those guys are mutant paddlers. They could paddle it easily back upwind. So, ultimately, I shouted out like a few times to see if anybody would hear me, and crickets.
Mm.
Other than the wind, there was nothing there. I mean, it was basically the wind and the waves slapping and everything, and it was blowing hard at that point. So, I decided that, within 60 seconds, I decided that I'm going to need to make moves towards the shore. That was just the only way that I could do it. It was like, I could either wait around in a black wetsuit on a black ocean, it was white capping, and wait for somebody to fly a helicopter out there. It wouldn't have happened. I was thinking, okay, how long is it going to take a boat to get out here from San Diego Bay? How long is it going to get the rib to get out of Del Mar Beach and down here? It's going to take an hour. I would think that it would take over an hour if they could even get there. I mean, at that,
Right.
So I just started swimming.
Well, when you made the decision to start swimming towards the beach, what was your kind of percentage in your head of survival at that point? Did you feel confident you'd make it to the beach, or was there any doubt?
I had, like, my, I'd say for the first 5 minutes or so, there was, I wouldn't say there's doubt, because I didn't, like, say I'm not going to make it, but I'm saying I'm going to have to put my head in this place and keep it there. Because if I don't, I won't make it.
The moment you have doubt creeping in, that's when you...
That's when I could not doubt myself. Like, I had to say, like, okay, I'm going to live for the next 10 minutes. And I'm gonna count strokes. And that's what I did. When I do, like, distance paddles, when I start to hurt, the first thing I'll do is start counting strokes. 20, 20, 20. And in this case, I did 20 crawl... And then I did 40 breaststroke, and then I did this combat swim thing on your side, on the one side, and then 1 minute of combat swim on the other side, and then 20. And basically every 10 minutes I'd revisit, like, what the story was. And
was there any way to tell if you're making progress towards shore?
There was no, like, stationary object that could guarantee me that I was making progress. And that was really my biggest concern. Like, am I just being sucked out to sea? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Like I passed numerous, like, kelp paddies. One actually had a bird on it that had just landed, trying to keep itself from getting blown away, I think. And it was just, I couldn't tell if the kelp paddy was getting blown out to sea and I was just stationary and swimming against, like, a 2 or 3 knot current, and I was just going to stay in the same place for the next 3 hours.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's important to note, too, that where Johnny is by himself swimming is basically right on top of the La Jolla Canyon, the Black's Beach Canyon, which is about 2 miles deep. It's the gnarliest canyon in Southern California. That's why, you know, canyon surfboards, it's what makes Black's Beach waves so great. And so there's an insane amount of freaky current there and a lot of creatures there. You know, and so you're about 20 minutes into your swim or whatever it is into your swim. Yeah. And then what do you see?
So I'm swimming and I take a breath on a breaststroke, and right in front of me is shark fin comes up, and it's about 50 feet away. And in that visibility wasn't great, but I could see it was swimming towards me, directly at me. And of course that, like,
so you see shark fin. Yeah, that freaks me
really
out.
So I'm just trying to immediately determine, like, what kind of shark it is. That's the whole, you know what I mean? There's lots of different kinds of sharks in San Diego, and not all of them are going to take a chunk out of me, you know what I mean? So I wanted to make sure that, like, it was, I was ready to take it on, I'll be honest with you. At that point in time, I think it has, there's some physiological thing that happens to you when you put in a situation of life or death. Like, all the ancillary nonsense that you worry about, all that you pay attention to, just seems to go away, and you get this, like, tunnel vision. So it's just me. I got no one else to rely on. So if this thing's coming at me, what am I going to do? Let it take me? Like, I'm going to give it as I was ready to do that. And as it came towards me about 10 feet away, it turned away, and I saw it was a blue shark. I was like,
oh, okay.
But it was a good size one, too. I mean, they get pretty big. So, but they don't eat
freaky
human beings for the most part, from what I knew anyway.
Crazy.
Anyway, so, and so from then on out, I'm swimming, but I'm keeping my eyes open, and I'm, you know, I'm looking behind me, because looking behind you, you know, can be the most freaky thing ever, because when you turn around, what you're looking at is kind of, the water is fairly smooth because the wind's blowing in the direction that you're at.
Mm-hmm.
When you turn around, all that bump and all the wind and all the chop, it looks much more ominous. And, you know, I was turning around just to make sure nothing was following me at that point in time, right?
So
I'm struggling for about 30 minutes or so going directly towards the beach, and then I decide I'm going to turn downwind, because I was really getting totally slapped.
Okay.
I mean, it was like swimming and the waves were slapping around, and I was burning a lot of energy, so I decided to go downwind.
Okay.
And that helped a lot, helped my emotional state, because I felt like I was making progress, even though, obviously, like I said, I was still concerned that I was actually not making progress, but other things were just floating by me. and then looking at the cliff started to get closer.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was actually, and because I was going northeast, I was going side on to the cliff, then I was really encouraged. Like, okay. At the point where I knew the cliff was getting closer, I was...
You're like, I'm making progress. Yeah, you're making progress, yeah. So that feels good.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, when you realize you're making progress, that's the most dangerous time, because what you do is you get over-enthusiastic and you like start trying to swim harder towards the shore because now I'm making progress. But who knows? I could have gotten an hour into the swim and the whole thing could have turned around again and pushed me back out to sea.
Sure.
So I had to keep myself from overextending, and I was just like nauseatingly slow.
So you eventually you made it to the surf line at Torrey Pines State Beach, more or less, sort of Blacks, the south end of Blacks.
Yeah.
And you're about to get onto the shore, and then what happens to you?
So I show up, I go through the kelp, and I come through, and obviously I get pulled right into this, like, massive rip.
So you get dumped into a rip
current. There's huge waves breaking there, and there's huge waves breaking there, and I get stuck right in the only rip that's going out. So I had to swim across the rip and get into the waves and the body surf to the shore, and I was just like, I got out of the ocean right next to this big flat rock that's in there. There were two people standing on the rock looking at me as if I was insane. Like, they were like, what, did you go for a swim? I went, yeah, kind of.
Wow.
I was like, yeah, it's all good. I just lost my board out there and I had to swim in, and they were like, oh, do you need a ride anywhere? I'm like, no, they're the guys that I went with. And I saw Rob, who had somehow seen me, he had seen somebody walking down the beach in black that he thought may have been me, but it wasn't. And then I came around the corner behind and I put up my arms and he was on the beach walking.
They realized that you were missing at some point.
Oh yeah, so they sat out there for 20 minutes waiting for me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they ultimately thought that either I paddle by, which is high in those conditions, it could have been. I may have just taken a different line and they just didn't ever see me. Or I was in trouble, and they made the right choice to paddle straight to shore and get the lifeguards on it. So
okay.
The thing is that it took them another, you know, fair amount of time to get to the shore. They had to paddle a few miles at least to get to shore, probably another 4 miles just to get to shore. And then they got on the phone with Mark, who's the deputy chief at Del Mar.
Okay.
And he was like, okay, where was he? You know, went through the hole. And then he called San Diego, and they were mustering a boat, and he was going to send the rib out from San Diego. And then they saw me.
Okay. So they were organizing a team that hadn't yet launched.
They hadn't yet, engaged. And
wow.
You know.
And eventually they picked up your board, right? They got into the rigid, hulled, inflatable boat that the Del Mar lifeguards use. They saw your board floating and spinning and getting taken by the wind. They went out there and tried to grab it. And, of course, it was still tumbling like a tumbleweed at them, so it took them numerous attempts to sort of corral the paddleboard into their boat.
How long was the total time, do you think, from when you lost your board till you made it to shore?
80 minutes. 81 minutes.
81 minutes of swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
Well, that's a great story. I know the takeaway from all of this, of course, Johnny's got a great website, paddleathlete.com, paddleathlete.com, and the story's on there, and I think, you know, what's the big takeaway here from this experience?
So never assume that you're gnarly enough to handle whatever's going to hit you. You need to be prepared no matter what. No matter what has happened to you in the past, no matter what are your previous experiences, and nothing's ever happened to you and you're pretty comfortable in those places and you've done it 100 times, always have the sense to expect the worst. And I'm not saying load your board up with massive amounts of safety gear and flares and all that stuff, but just do the bare minimum. Like, the bare minimum for me would wear a colored cutoff over the top of my wetsuit, like something that was visible from the air.
Yeah.
Wear a leash. I mean, how difficult would it that? I mean, that would have basically taken this whole situation. It wouldn't even have existed.
Yeah.
You know, if I'd worn a leash. And And I think prone paddlers in general are kind of come from the surfing world, and the whole purpose of paddling to begin with was to prepare them for big surf, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the concept of wearing a leash when you've been surfing Waimea Bay at 30 feet is kind of ridiculous.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so that's where the culture comes from. So
right.
That's my answer to your question.
All right. Well,
yeah.
Crew, great story. I'm glad you could come by and tell us. I appreciate you swinging by.
Glad you made it, man.
Yeah, Johnny.
That's harrowing.
You're back and you're good. And
you fully recovered?
See you in the water.
You will see me in the water.
Yeah.
Nice. Thanks, Johnny.
Take care.
Cool. So, interesting story. I'm glad we got the first person account there. Of that.
Yeah, great story.
That
Jeez.
Yeah.
Freaky stuff, man.
Let's see. Where do you want to start the rest of the show, David?
My name's David Scales, SurfSplendorPodcast.com, on social media at Surf Splendor. Simulcasting this with your show, Scott.
Yeah.
So. We got a lot to catch up on. I mean,
Do you want to start with the swell here?
It's
a good
segue.
I mean, I'm sure that...
The swell that we were just talking about, that experience took place in during Stormageddon, as Southern California news media has
Stormageddon.
Called it. Stormageddon.
I
massive
love it.
Swell. Surfline actually just posted a featured article on it last night.
Yeah,
the title is SoCal Pumps.
Yeah.
So you can see lots of photos. For all the listeners, we'll post links to that on our websites. And you can see the photos that came out of this swell. But a lot of rain, too. So all of the runoff has been funneled into the ocean. So the water's all brown and disgusting and hepatitis-filled. But the waves are also pumping. So if you're willing to brave the infection... You'll get good waves, you know.
You know, here's my notes on it is that this, first and foremost, the swell came up in the middle of the day really quickly from small surf Saturday morning to the San Nicolas buoy was 20 feet at 14 seconds at around 11 o'clock in the morning, which is about 2 hours away. And by midday and all afternoon, it was absolutely huge here in San Diego. And, Richard Kenvin made an interesting insight on Facebook about this, which I thought was really worthy, which was, you know, that cyclone that spun right off the coast that created these waves was in a position such that for the first time in a long time, Point Conception didn't have the opportunity to shadow the swell energy. So we got a lot of raw and strong and powerful swell without that shadowing, without that filtering, which doesn't happen very often. So, it was a definitely a major swell event here in San Diego, and Swami's was as big as I've surfed it since, 1983, the El Nino year of 1983, and it was massive, and it was purely a matter of luck if you made it out or not. You know, there's that first line of defense, that powerful whitewater. If you can get through that and get to the so-called channel, you're more or less safe unless you ride the wave too far. And so getting out through that first line of defense, I had actually given up, and somehow or another things let up for half a second, and I got in a rip, and I was like, oh, I do have a chance, and I just powered through it and got out, luckily, you know?
Yeah.
And there were many surfers that that are better, you know, quote-unquote water people than me that didn't have that dumb luck that I had and couldn't make it out and tried. It was enormous, and La Jolla Cove broke, which here in San Diego, that's a definite sign that, you know, we've got major swell. And,
right.
It was a definite, you know, big wave swell event. Big Saturday, they're calling it. So Big Saturday here in San Diego, March 1st, 2014.
Yeah, and I'm up in Orange County, Huntington Beach, and it's just open ocean there, you know, and beach break too, so... When the waves are that big, it's too big to even surf. You have to go find a nook and cranny. But there's a couple spots just north of Orange County, South LA County, Long Beach specifically, which has a big break wall, and it's basically a harbor that rarely ever breaks. It's normally flat and dormant in there, but on this swell, it was actually head high, super good, super fun, and that might have to do with the Point Conception thing that you were talking about, not blocking that specific direction. Little waves sneak in there and kind of refract off a jetty and it was actually really, really good. So everywhere else was not surfable around my house, and that spot was pumping, you know, and not a lot of guys out. Yeah. So got to surf some different novelty waves, which is cool.
Very cool.
What's going on, though? Recap. Last episode, you were talking about your malaise and lack of motivation to surf and relating it to Jason Board's blog of how surfing ruined my life.
Yes.
Are you still in that funk or what?
No, I mean, something about, you know, 12 to 15 foot waves that, you know, I've been excited. I've caught some of the greatest waves I've caught in a long time this last weekend. So
good.
I'm not in that funk. I'm excited to be in the water. And
good.
And quite frankly, and this may be our segue, but watching the Snapper event has got me excited to ride my little Shred WCT model. And I've been very inspired by the surfing I've been seeing. And I'll be brutally honest and tell you, I'm extremely inspired by some of the girls surfing. And I'm blown away, quite frankly, yeah, by the level of the women surfing. And I'm, you know, I've been in the past, I've been the guy that's like, oh, whatever, you know, we really just want to see Kelly and Mick Fanning go at it, you know. And the girls are good, yeah, whatever, but I will backpedal a little bit and just tell you that I'm just so impressed by Carissa Moore. She's truly just a notch above a lot of guys. I mean, she's surfing incredible.
I think that I agree with you that the women's surfing yesterday was all time. There's two, maybe three girls that are light years ahead of the other girls. Carissa Moore, without a doubt. Steph Gilmore's right there. And right kind of just below them is Courtney Conlogue in my mind.
I would throw Malia Manuel in there too.
See, I'm not necessarily on board. Malia surfed really well on a couple waves.
Yeah.
But she doesn't have the consistency.
Yeah.
There's been times, like when she won the U.S. Open, where I thought, wow, she is on par with Carissa.
Yeah.
But on a heat-to-heat basis, she doesn't bring that same level, you know?
You know, you mentioned Steph Gilmore, and you're right. Steph Gilmore and Carissa Moore, this is a rivalry that the ASP would be smart to nurture this. I don't want an artificial rivalry, but I think there's got to be a true rivalry here.
Mm-hmm.
And even with Courtney, and there's some other girls that are really fired up, like Lakey Peterson. They just seem to be really competitive.
I agree, and we saw a new rivalry perhaps start yesterday among the Goofy Footers. Bianca Butendog from South Africa, and then Alessa Quizon from Hawaii.
Yeah.
They both had a heat together, and they were shredding. Bianca got the better of the exchange. She's 6'1", super powerful, but like amazing backhand surfer. So that was cool. I think they're both rookies too. Alessa is for sure.
You know, it almost seems like the bandwagon to get on right now is like, oh yeah, the women's tour is insane. But it is kind of insane. Like, I just tuned in yesterday just because the waves looked like they were going to get good. And I was like, oh, the waves will be good. And I'll do some work and I'll watch the webcast. And I wasn't really, like, keyed up to watch it. But I was truly found myself going, wow, Carissa Moore is mind-blowing. You know, that one heat she had where, you know, she had a 19-point whatever. She really just was, it was fun to watch her surf, and it was inspiring. It inspired me to go try to shred, get my shred on at my local little beach break. Yeah.
Break out your two-piece?
No, I didn't break out the two-piece, but I will say this, that it seems to me that Steph Gilmore, and maybe this is because it's the quote-unquote Roxy Pro, but it seems like they're pushing Steph Gilmore a little bit too overtly. Like, they have already anointed her as the world champion. And, you know, like, if you look at the ASP press release today that came out, it's like, I think the title was quarterfinalists decided at the Roxy Pro. And then the next paragraph was like, Steph Gilmore had a great, but truly anyone that watched the event yesterday knows that the story and the press release, the title should have been all about Carissa Moore, basically throwing down the gauntlet, setting such a high mark for the other girls to try to get to. Yesterday was about Carissa Moore. It was not about Steph Gilmore. And the ASP press release should not lead off with Steph Gilmore. And I know that the ASP is like, Steph Gilmore's our gal. She's the one that's going to, like, push women's surfing into the next millennium or the next decade, if you will. And I just think that it's just irresponsible to not put Carissa where she needs to be.
I think there's a little bit of that, but I think
there's a lot of that.
Well, no, but hear me out.
You see her on the webcast I'm out to win number 14.
That is true, but what I'm saying there's a little bit of is the motivation. I think the other motivation is the reality of Steph Gilmore's a 5-time world champ at her home break. And and what you're saying, I think the other thing is, like, this is the...
how many world titles does Carissa have?
Two?
Yeah, maybe two, maybe three, I don't know.
Yeah, but that's not five.
Right,
it's like when we talk about...
She's the reigning world champion, though.
Right, and so she got her due probably in the next paragraph, and she surfed incredibly well.
Wait a minute. Is the story of yesterday that Steph Gilmore is the five-time world champion, and she deserves a due no matter what?
No, but no matter where Kelly Slater shows up, they talk about the 11-time world champion.
I'm not saying don't talk about Steph. I'm just saying don't lead the press release off with Steph Gilmore surfed great. She beat who, and she beat this person. I'm saying the story needs to be... Because look, everyone saw what happened yesterday. The story was Carissa Moore dominated the situation.
I don't disagree at all, and I love Carissa Moore. But I'm saying because somebody surfed one or two heats great, you know, that...
That was the story of yesterday. That was the press release. They put out the press release about what happened yesterday.
Sure.
What happened yesterday is that Carissa Moore dominated.
Sure.
Steph didn't look all that solid. She had some good heats, some good waves, but there was moments where... There was one heat where she was sort of out of rhythm.
I'm surprised by how easily shaken Steph is, actually. She was even saying she was nervous in one of the heats. And it's like, you're the five-time world champ. You shouldn't be nervous. And you have the ability to trounce the best of them.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. And there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
The other story that I think got overshadowed, though, was Courtney Conlogue. Did you see that heat where she got that insane barrel?
Yeah.
And she got a 9.7, I think she had a 9.5 and a 9.7 or something, almost as good as Carissa's. I don't think that she has the variety in surfing that Carissa has, and she's all power base. She blows tail occasionally, but she's always kind of stiff-legged on everything, whereas Carissa's a little bit more nimble and rubber band-like. So, but Courtney, I mean, I think she is amazing, and if she can find that flexibility in her surfing, she can contend with Steph Gilmore and Carissa.
And I agree, and I'll tell you this, that I'm truly looking forward to the quarterfinals of the women's draw. I sincerely am excited about it, and it reminds me of women's tennis a few years back when it was, whoever, there was some great rivalries, maybe the Williams sisters and Monica Seles or whoever it was. I just remember women's tennis was really fun to watch because it was so competitive, and I seem to be getting that way. Like I'm blown away that I'm excited to watch the quarterfinals at Snapper. It seems like a great way for the girls to really display what they have.
It does. The other note that I have about watching it was that their post-heat interviews are far more entertaining than the men. Like I had it on mute a couple times because I was working, and once they show their face, I turn the volume up, and it's, first of all, they're beautiful to look at. You know, Malia Manuel or Alyssa Quizon, when they come on, they're just absolutely cute, gorgeous, and it's like, wow. And then I turn the volume up and listen to them talk. They're super well-spoken. They're articulate. They're excited. They're giddy with excitement, which is something that you don't see from the men that often. Courtney Conlogue, I'll say again, her post-heat interview when she got that barrel in the couple of nines, she was giddy like a Grom, and like, I can't wait, I'm gonna go home, I'm gonna watch surf videos tonight, and I'm gonna get frothed out, and I'm gonna wake up early tomorrow morning. And she was giggly, she couldn't contain it. And she's usually one who's a little bit more pragmatic and like reserved and athletic-like, but she couldn't contain her froth from getting barreled at Snapper, you know? So I just thought that that was something that will go a long way for the women surfing, that enthusiasm that they express. And Lakey Peterson said, that was the most beautiful time I've ever spent in an ocean anywhere, where her competitor was on the ski getting pulled out the back, so she was the only person in the lineup. That was the last heat of the day, so she goes, I looked at the rocks, and Mick Fanning was standing there waiting to paddle out. I was at Snapper by myself. The men's world champ can't even paddle out. She's like, that was the most beautiful moment I've ever had in the ocean. And it's like, whoa, that's a huge call. But she's right. It was. The sun was kind of going down. It was amazing, you know?
She's obviously never surfed Cardiff Reef.
Apparently not.
Well, good for her.
Yeah.
What else do you got? Quicksilver Pro?
Yeah.
Jordy Smith is sort of the big story, right?
Yeah.
He got eliminated. He was upset by Thiago Perez.
Uh-oh. Dog's trying to chime in on the show.
Hey.
Who do we got here joining for a new interview?
It's my wife. Come here. So, like I was saying, Jordy Smith, Thiago Perez surfed incredible. Don't worry about the chair.
I just broke Scott's chair, by the way.
That happens. We've got all sorts of stuff. Dogs barking, chairs breaking. Thiago Perez, to me, looked, incredible. Like, really, hey, get over here. Really on form. So I was pretty excited about watching Thiago.
That's funny that you say that. I felt like he did a couple good turns.
There were a couple turns that were sick.
Yeah, and he deserved to win that heat without a doubt, but his surfing is so uninspiring to me that I was so bummed to see him take out Jordy. And Jordy blew it, of course. Jordy waited forever for a set wave that never came. So Thiago deserved to win. But watching Thiago, it was like, good God, please don't win this heat. I don't want to watch you surf in the next round.
Really, I was so impressed by his style. And I'll be the first one to sort of poo-poo any non-American surfer. I'll look for the flaw. I can see the flaws quicker than most. But Thiago, I thought, looked so sharp, and I was very impressed with his style, and he looked like a surfer that I'd like to see move on through the next round. And
wow.
Yeah, and believe me, it surprised me, but yeah. There was a couple turns that he did where I was like, wow, those are pretty sharp, you know?
He's always had those turns, he just doesn't often hit them, you know? Yeah. He always had the ability. I will say one thing about Thiago's surfing that I notice, just in terms of board design. I'm watching him surf on the wave, and it's like, well, he's obviously riding a pintail. And he gets out of the water, and you look, and he is. And it's just that really round style of turning. Everything, it's like you could draw a circle. If you followed his path with a pen on the TV, it would just be this circular, never a straight moment in his, or a sharp, talked about in the past, Sonny Garcia just kind of thumping the tail when he does that turn.
Yeah.
There's none of that with Thiago surfing. It's so round, and that's what you get out of that pintail design, you know? There's no sharp moments in your motion.
Well, that's interesting insight, and I'm okay with that. I love smooth and
round. Of course,
I guess the other upset, well, definitely the other upset, right, is John Florence.
Totally.
Yeah.
John Florence got taken out by Travis Logie, right?
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. As you know, Travis Logie is sort of a champion killer. I mean, he's lethal. He's a guy that you don't want to draw in your heat. He's got tons of experience on tour. He's a veteran. He's taken out the best. He has no fear about... He's not a guy that goes, oh, no, I got Kelly in my heat. He's like, bring it. Let's do this. And he proved that he can do it again. And he was a guy I always toy with on my fantasy team, and I took him off of my team before this event. Obviously, I'm disappointed about that. John Florence, you know, there's a lot to be said for if you don't move on in the first event, what it means for your chances of winning a world title this year. I'm sure you heard perhaps Martin Potter and those guys talking about how important it is to not have this event be a throwaway from the standpoint of momentum going into the rest of the Australian leg and just moving forward. I mean, you're basically down an event. Everyone else is up an event, you know?
Right.
And so, I think a lot of us would love to see John Florence win a world title, and now he's dug himself a bit of a hole.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. I think you also don't want to hinge everything on your first performance. Shake it off, move on. John's got unbelievable talent and a long time ahead. I'd be bummed out if he really put too much weight on that one loss, you know? He'll be all right.
It seemed as if Jordy Smith put a lot of weight on that loss. He's a guy that, as the announcers mentioned, he's had this, you know, best to not win a world title sort of moniker placed on him. And, you know, the swing and the miss at the surfboard that you sent me, which was, everyone noticed that, you know, what a great moment, you know?
Yeah, basically after he lost his heat, he held his board up to punch it and just kind of missed completely, and yeah. It's hilarious.
It is hilarious.
Yeah, so I posted that on Instagram. Follow @SurfSplendor if you want to see that little video bit.
It's super
it's funny.
Awkward, you know? It's an awkward moment. He could have hurt his shoulder. I mean, he swung as hard as he could and missed.
Yeah, yeah. And then Felipe Toledo lost his heat against Mitch Cruz, and at the end tried to, like, stomp on his board to put his foot through it in frustration as well. And I think that those two instances are moments that are kind of embarrassing when you, in turn, look at the women. And I was using that example of how excited they are just to be surfing snapper. And then you got these guys who are acting like children when they lose, you know? It's a, I don't know, there's a little bit of a dichotomy there.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing.
It is a little bit embarrassing. Brett Simpson, I noticed, had similar little flare-up. And, yeah. You're right. A little bit embarrassing, and maybe we're showing our true colors as the male gender.
Let me we got to do a little bit more ASP talk, just because there is the new change in the ASP, or there's a number of new changes. Do you have any thoughts on the good versus the bad of the first event that we have so far?
Well, the first thing I'll tell you is that this photographic ban that the ASP put out a couple of weeks ago, maybe last week. And they basically said, look, if you're taking photos on our space, we have the rights to those photos. We can use them whenever we want, and we're not going to pay you. And obviously, it lit up a bit of a firestorm amongst the photographers who are used to, you know, year after year after year getting a media pass and having the rights to those images for them to sell. And it's how they make a living. And Peter Jolie Wilson put a little blog out about how this is just crap. They can just walk up and ask for your media card anytime, and you have to hand it over. And
well, let's clarify real quick.
Yeah,
they can't take anybody's. It's if you ask them for a media pass for the event, and they issue the media pass, that's part of the agreement, is that they have rights to your photos.
Right.
So if you're just there as a spectator on the beach shooting a photo, they don't have the right to come commandeer your media card.
Well, and I guess that begs the question. How do you determine who's who? Like,
if they have a media pass around their neck.
Right, well, then why would you get a media pass?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Maybe the applications for media passes drop severely.
Yeah. Well, I think that I want to back up a little bit and talk about the ASP at large, because I feel like there's all this debate of and it's easy to point fingers at kind of where their flaws are and what they're doing poorly this year.
I just, as a caveat to what you're going to say, and I hope you say this, I'm sure you probably will, I think it's too early to start pointing fingers at the ASP. Let's give them until, Sean Doherty wrote a great piece about this. We need to give them a couple of events before we start pointing fingers. Now,
yeah.
I'm not saying let's not look at flaws and suggest areas where we think maybe they could improve, but let's give them some time to iron out the wrinkles.
Yeah, I like that Sean Doherty piece too. I think he's a great writer.
He's
an
awesome writer, and he provides great insight. The best thing about it is that you get all the insight and more that you would get from him as a commentator,
yeah,
but without the 15-second vowels.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I got you. I saw that post on Facebook.
I know you did. Look at that. I think you had too much caffeine.
Yeah. So let me backtrack real quick. I want to explain my understanding of the ASP and their positioning and see if you feel the same way or if it's reality or maybe you can steer me clear.
Yeah.
So the ASP comes about, you know, in the 70s or whatever, Association of Surfing Professionals.
Yeah, it was the IPS.
Okay.
It was Fred Hemmings' deal. There was a power struggle in 83. Many will tell you that the real beginnings of the ASP was 1983. And Ian Cairns came along and threw some, I don't know how it all went down, but there was some politics involved, obviously, and some drama. But he wrestled professional surfing away from Fred Hemmings in 1983. And then Ian Cairns, that's when the ASP was started. But yes, professional surfing in its modern form started in 76.
And for the most part, it struggled to find a solid revenue stream and to be profitable, right? More or less?
Yeah.
Okay. And so part of their model for doing so is partnering up with the big five surf brands, right?
In the past, that's where the revenues were from.
So Quiksilver sponsors an event, puts up prize money, pays for the broadcast. Now it's a webcast, essentially. But they front all the money.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And so the prize money has always been dependent upon those brands, which are then in turn sponsoring the surfers as well. And the ASP is beholden to those companies, essentially.
Yeah.
Right?
Basically.
So it's it's a model, a business model that is designed for potential corruption, essentially, and potential when it comes to judging the sport, supposedly unbiasedly. You know, it sets itself up for a lot of failure. So in a mission to kind of make it more mainstream and make it less political, Zozee has gotten involved in recent years, and they bought the ASP for $0. But with the goal of making it profitable and then everybody wins, right?
Yes.
So this is the first year that Zozee is involved. And
it's the second year, but it's the first year of their...
Their new...
Their here we are, this is the new ASP.
And in the past, the guys who have kind of run the ASP, guys like you named, probably did it out of a passion project more than it was a getting rich scheme. You know what I mean? Because there wasn't a lot of money involved. So part of Zozee's method is like, hey, let's hire these... proven execs with a lot of experience from other industries, bring them in, and we will make this a profitable business. Correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So this year, that mission is let's bring on non-endemic sponsors like Samsung, GoPro, somewhat endemic, but they will then fund this thing. We'll get real revenue dollars. We'll up the prize money. Surfers will make more money. Hopefully, the clothing companies that are sponsoring those surfers will make more money in the end. Everybody wins, right?
Yeah.
So in that mission and in that goal, I think they're thinking, let's kind of do away with some of the normal surfer stereotypes and make this more professional looking. Let's try to make the judging a little more objective and make it more mainstream. Let's not use curse words. Let's not use bro-isms, you know? And so I think that's what we're seeing with the commentary, and what we're going to see with a lot of the backlash to the ASP is going to come from the main core base who's been watching all along saying, hey, this is getting too vanilla, too bland. You guys are making it too mainstream.
Too NFL, too mainstream.
And
the Americanization of the sport is what you hear from a lot of Australians.
Right. And you're cutting away to too many commercials, which, you know, is a necessary evil. I'm gonna throw back to that a lot because I think what we get for those commercials are, you know, super high quality imagery and super slow motion, being able to see Josh Kerr's club sandwich turn that he does in really high quality slow-mo over and over again. That's the trade-off. And so as we continue to have this conversation about the ASP and the pros and cons that are coming out of Zozee's involvement, we're gonna have to realize that there are very real benefits that we get out of it for whatever cons are involved. But I also think that there is a legitimate complaint in the commentary's super vanilla, super bland. They're making it, there's no drama in the commentary. If you watch the NFL, NBA, the ML, the Major Baseball, Major League Baseball, the UFC even, you know, it's like the commentators are allowed to criticize the athlete's technique and even the judging technique. It's not so vanilla.
Yeah, I would suggest to you that I think that early on in the early rounds, they're actually too enthusiastic about some of this stuff.
That's what I would agree. And they're blowing sunshine up
everybody's butt. It's like everyone's going, really? It's just like, oh, well, you know. So I think they're being overly enthusiastic, overly excited about what's being presented. I think they need to hold and build up that excitement to the finals.
Yeah, I agree.
And I also agree with you that they're not being, and this has always been a problem, that they're not being... They don't have enough constructive criticism.
Right.
It's like everything everyone's doing is great, and it's not.
No,
it
isn't.
And everyone knows it, and please point out, you know, the obvious, because we all see it, you know. And that's where you get that Johnny Miller, you know, that analogy I always use, that we need a Johnny Miller or a John McEnroe, a guy that can go in there and call it like he sees it, that is a past champion, that isn't afraid to go, you know what, that was lame.
Yeah.
that was stupid, that was lame, that was bad, that was, you know, I'm sure he's upset with himself. And not with malice. You know, we don't need, like, that Lewis Samuels vibe. You know, we're not out to be, like, sophomore 24-year-olds. You know, but we just want some professional broadcasting. I mean, if a guy trips and falls in a football game, the announcer goes, that guy's an idiot, you know?
Totally. And that's what we're... And we need drama. And, I mean, that's what makes commentary interesting. And these just kind of blowing sunshine up everybody and just narrating what's happening on the waves isn't entertaining enough when you're watching the webcast. You want to have somebody being critical and perhaps the two commentators having opposite opinions on who they think is the better surfer. That's where the value is.
They need us. They need David and Scott.
I think, yeah, let's send in our resumes. And so I think that maybe they'll make those adjustments moving forward and they recognize the failures of this first or the shortcomings of this first broadcast. But I think that even if the commentators wanted to offer those criticisms, they're afraid of losing their job probably, because we saw Damian Farrenfort and Jake Patterson lose their jobs at the Quick Pro France when they criticized the judging, you know, in that event last year. So I think everybody's kind of sitting on the edge of their seats trying to just do the right thing right now.
Yeah.
And it's providing a kind of bland vanilla experience.
Yeah. Everyone's got a new boss. They don't know how to deal with the new boss. And that's why I say, you know, let's give this thing till Rio or till Tahiti to kind of see where we're at, you know. They're going to rely on people like us and the Sean Dohertys of the world to call it like we see it. And there's many of us out there. There's many voices. The Inertia, Surfer Magazine, Surfing Transworld, Tim Baker, Stab Magazine, you know, all the Australian surfing world, all of the tracks, all those outlets are saying the same thing that you and I are saying, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And it's going to correct itself.
I think in terms of what they're doing right, I think that the overall look, the graphics and all that kind of stuff looks good. You know, it looks more professional. It's just a cleaner delivery of everything. The feed has been flawless pretty much. Some of the scoring on the right gets bogged down and you have to refresh it again. They also, I don't know if you noticed this, but on the ASP's YouTube page, they've started doing a judge's assessment at the end of each day.
No, I did not know that.
Richie Porta sits down with it's the morning show the following day. Richie Porta sits down and explains critical calls like the Stephanie Gilmore interference call in round one of the Roxy Pro. He sat down and explained why they made that call. So I think that's a really cool addition, where in the past we said, man, how do the judges justify these calls that they're making? He's, you know, addressing those things. So I think that's a cool addition.
Well, I won't be happy, as you know, until they initiate that, you know, I don't know what we would call it, but the judges in the blind, if you will, where the judges are not allowed to know what the surfer needs to advance. They need to be in a cone of silence. And I think that would do a lot to alleviate some of the, you know, online or in the surf media, to eliminate that. What's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, I agree. Just their elimination of knowing what scores need to be gathered before they score this ride.
Yeah, to eliminate some of the unneeded criticism that they might be getting. You know, like if we know they don't know, then we can't really criticize them. You know,
totally. Yeah. A couple of other things. I want to keep this in mind as we move forward through the event and through future events too. I'm concerned about the ASP getting too bland and too vanilla. And one thing that Martin Potter kept saying was Seabass, for example, would go for a huge turn, or John did that huge layback that he fell on that cost him the heat.
Yeah.
And Martin Potter would say he needs to tone it down. He just needs to surf at 75% to get through this heat. Martin Potter's assessment is correct, but my concern is, do we want to watch an event where guys are surfing at 75% to get through heats?
I think that they're going to be surfing good, hard rail turns. I think what they're saying is save the aerials for the semis when you really need them. You know, save the big layback for when you really need it. Now, John probably really needed that.
Do we want to encourage that type of surfing?
Well, I don't think we're encouraging. I don't think Martin Potter's encouraging. I don't think the surfers are listening to what Martin Potter's saying. But, you know, 75% round one heat with John John's pretty killer. And it would be silly of him to set the bar so high for himself that he can't outdo himself in the finals.
I agree with that in theory, and I've probably promoted that in the past. I just can't
help. You want 100% of the time.
I don't want it, but I just can't help when Potter's saying that, feeling like that is the overall vibe of the event. Is like, let's pull everything back from the outskirts into the bell-shaped curve, do everything kind of middle of the road to get the most viewers, to get Procter & Gamble involved as a sponsor, make it palatable for everybody. If you get the chance to hit that high note, go ahead and hit it occasionally, but let's just kind of keep everything tailored in the middle to keep everybody happy. That's kind of what I feel like is implied. And I don't think Potter's doing that implicitly, but that's kind of the overall feel that I'm getting from it. Whereas that one turn, again, that club sandwich turn that Josh Kerr did, that's arguably 110% commitment. He landed it buttery without a stutter in his step, and it's something that could be pulled out in the final, but he did it in round one or round two or whatever round it was. And, man, that was just the highlight of the day, you know? I mean, that was unbelievable, and I don't see why that shouldn't be.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You're basically saying, look, surf for the moment. Surf like you're in a free surf. You know, why wouldn't you try that, you know, yesterday out at your local break? And if you would, then why wouldn't you do it in your heat? Because we want to see the limits pushed. We want to see the barriers pushed. We want to see that litmus, that line very, very high. And that's valid.
I also believe that, honestly, John John has the ability to pull off that layback at 100% that he actually didn't pull off. And if he did, I think that Kelly Slater and Gabriel Medina and the other guys are going to surf their next heat on a brand new level in a new gear that they didn't have before they saw John John do it. And that's the momentum that I want the sport to have.
Yeah.
Is a new 100% is set every heat.
Yeah.
They like have it. The talent to do it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because it's not like, you know, your round one heat is even remembered relative 4 days later when you're in the semifinals or the finals.
No. And you're getting paid $4 million bucks a year. You should be doing that for us.
Yeah, you better.
Dance.
Damn you.
Dance, John John, dance.
What else do you got?
Well, I hate to make this all ASP conversation, but Jay Bay is back on the list. Bali, the Karamas event, is off. So Jay Bay's replacing Karamas. So that's worth noting. And I think we're excited about Jay Bay. I'm bummed that Karamas is gone, especially considering how amazing an event it was last year.
You know, I thinking back on what we were talking about, giving the ASP a pass until a certain time, you and I, did we do this yet? But we should put a cutoff point, if it's Rio or whatever it is, and do a look back at that point, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Okay. We should also say to the listeners, even though we just talked about the quick pro for 20 minutes, we'll do a quick pro recap of the entire event, because we're just kind of hitting certain highlights right now. But there's going to be a lot more to discuss in the coming days. It's today, actually, as we're recording this episode, they're probably going to start round three of the men's and maybe the quarterfinal of the women's. So a lot of that will have taken place by the time listeners are listening to this. So we'll recap all that in a separate episode.
So what do you think about Nicolas Cage showing up at the Quicksilver Pro? Do you read that that's the new ASP and all of the Hollywood connections that Paul Speaker and all these Disney execs have? All of these rich people... Are they pulling strings and going, you know what, do me a favor, roll down for a couple hours and say hi to Kelly?
No.
And do you think that Kelly's getting a call from his agent going, hey, Nicolas Cage is going to roll down, hang out with him, we want some photo ops? You do think that was an organic thing, that Nicolas Cage just rolled up?
I remember the U.S. Open a couple years back, Sean Penn, Pamela Anderson, like all sorts of celebrities were at that event. Just behind the scenes, it wasn't publicized or anything. And who's Nicolas Cage, by the way? I mean... I know he's done a bunch of movies.
Did you read Doherty's thing?
No, I didn't.
Well, read Sean Doherty's thing because it's great. It's like, hey, Matthew McConaughey a couple of years ago rolled up at the Snapper, the Quicksilver Pro. He was on a career low light, having just made the movie Surfer Dude. He was basically been, you know, reduced to a D-level actor. And, you know, 2 days ago he won the Academy Award for Best Actor. So his thing is, Nicolas Cage is sort of where Matthew McConaughey is.
Nicolas Cage is going, hey, if Matthew did this, maybe I should try this. So I'm going to go hang out with Kelly at the Quicksilver Pro. Maybe my career will turn around.
That's funny. Yeah. I think surfing has appeal to everybody and people want to go check it out. You know, that's all that that is. I don't think it's a publicity thing.
You and I have talked about Sean Doherty, and I'll do it again. I highly recommend that you read Sean Doherty. It's too bad, although I could do without his really enthusiastic Australian accent. He's probably the premier voice for professional surfing, in my opinion. He's one of the great journalists. And if you get a chance, read his blog. You can find it on coastalwatch.com, which is Australia's version of Surfline.
Yeah, and we'll post it on our websites too, surfsplendorpodcast.com, downthelineradio.com. By the way,
did you notice that I've been ripping off your... I love your website. It's so organized and stuff that I just go, oh, I'm just going to grab all...
Oh, really?
I'm going to grab all the stuff that David's posting and just...
You've actually
I've been mimicking your site.
Basically. You've been to my website?
Yeah, I went to your website.
Have you ever listened to an episode of Surf Splendor?
I don't think I have.
Whoa. I don't think you have either, but... I'll tell you what.
That I don't want to, but my life is I'm engaged with a lot of stuff here.
Yeah, the things that you want to do.
So, you got me there.
Let's make a deal.
Okay.
For every boardroom show I go to, which is a weekend out of my life,
yeah. You
listen to 1 hour of Surf Splendor.
I will do that.
Yeah, right.
No.
So you're one episode back on me then, because I've been to one boardroom show.
Okay, all right. Look, it's not that I assume as soon as I listen, I'm going to be hooked, and it'll be another podcast. Do you want to see the podcast that I listen to?
No, I don't, actually.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour, my friend. Have you ever listened to the Thomas Jefferson Hour?
I have this week, because you posted a Facebook recommendation on it.
What did you think?
This current episode sucks. It's just boring. It's about weather.
Yeah.
But I went back because I know Jefferson is a huge wine enthusiast.
Yes.
As am I.
Yes.
So I went back and listened to the wine episode, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm currently listening to the one about the women in Jefferson's life, which I thought was going to be a little bit more scandalous, but instead they just spent most of the hour talking about his mom and his sister and his wife.
And daughters and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a big history freak, so I enjoyed the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Yeah, it's a good show. So the other...
By the way, did you know that I've been on the Thomas Jefferson Hour?
No.
Yes. In the past, they would have listeners call in questions, and I called in to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and I said, hey, my name's Scott. I'm from Southern California. I'm a surfer. I ride waves. I want to know what Mr. Jefferson thinks about the concept of, riding waves, the idea of not working, to the idea of what surfers are, this, you know, just hedonistic, just pleasure, ride waves. You know, and they listened to my voicemail on the air, and they answered my question.
Cool. Yeah. What did he have to say about it?
He basically kind of said, you know, Mr. Jefferson would look down on it because it's like, you know, you're either working, you know, his work ethic would have a problem with the idea of beach bums searching out the perfect ride.
I think they have a misconception about surfers. The beach bum conception, you know, it's kind of like that is the prevailing stereotype, of course, but... We are hardworking, dedicated enthusiasts, you know?
And we're not
different. Of a Jefferson work ethic, even.
Yeah, I think that Lewis and Clark would have enjoyed watching us ride waves. And we're no different than climbers or mountain bikers or golfers or, you know, we're just people that enjoy what our passion is.
Yeah. One last ASP note on my end, which I would like to pat myself on the back for. Throwing it back 4 or 6 months into last season, I said, I heard industry rumors. I think Dane is going to try to requalify in 2014. I would say it looks like he's trying to requalify in 2014 now that we're here. He did the two QS events
in Australia.
He looked
good in Hawaii. And he looked good in Hawaii.
Looked good
year.
In Hawaii. Yeah. And the QS events in Australia at Manly, it's like he's surfing knee-high waves, but he was actually trying his best
right.
to get scores out there. And now he's into round 3 at the Quick Pro, which is going to garner him some points. So he's looking more fit, looking enthusiastic.
Well, I think all of North America wants to see that happen. I know that the ASP wants to see that happen. And I know that the powers that be behind the scenes at the ASP, the people that are pulling strings perhaps at Quicksilver, are nudging Dane in that regard. And I'm sure Kelly's probably had some words with him too about it.
He entered the Bolito, the Mr. Price Pro at Bolito, which is I think it's a 6-star in
yeah.
South Africa. So he's already committed to that event too.
Okay, well that says a lot. And
exciting times.
That would be good, and I hope Dane goes a very long way in this event.
I'm going to introduce a new segment to our program this week.
Cool.
It's called This Week in Surf History.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I love it.
So this segment is where I go on to the Encyclopedia of Surfing.com. Not a plug for them, but yes, it is kind of.
Go ahead.
And I just randomly pick one of their tiles, and mm-hmm. I choose to talk about that.
Okay.
To give listeners insight into surf history.
All right.
And this one I actually chose strategically because of the amazing performance in the Roxy Pro yesterday. Women's surfing, I think, just hit a new high point. So I wanted to bring up a female surfer named Phyllis O'Donnell.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with Phyllis O'Donnell, Scott Bass?
Phyllis O'Donnell?
Phyllis O'Donnell.
I don't think I am.
Wispy, regular foot surfer from Sydney, Australia. Hmm. No bells rung?
No, it's not ringing a bell at all.
Here's why she should ring a bell.
All right.
Is because she was the winner of the 1964 Surfing World Championships. The first ever women's world champion surfer.
Okay, 1964.
1964. That is an important note in surf history. She began surfing at the age of 23, and a mere 4 years later, she was the surprise winner of the Australian national titles. And just a few weeks after that, at Sydney's Manly Beach, she defeated American champion Linda Benson to become the sport's first ever world champion when she was 27 years old. And she was also the oldest female competitor in the event by more than 3 years. So she had only been surfing for 4 years. She was the oldest competitor at age 27. And I guess she was just known for being 5'2", small, really friendly, really smiley and happy. Everybody loved her. But in the water, she was a terror. And she even said, quote, "I was a horribly, horribly aggressive, and I swore like a trooper." And then after she retired from surfing, I guess she worked at Dewey Weber Surfboards in the South Bay of California for a little bit. She judged events. She appeared in a few surf films. And then in 1996, she was inducted into the Australian Surfing Hall of Fame. So that is the legacy of Phyllis O'Donnell this week in surf history.
Cool. Well, that's a great segment. Good job on that.
Thanks.
I like it.
Thanks.
I am not prepared for a kook or duke or anything like that. I got to admit, I'm just rolling. I'm winging it.
That's okay. One final note. Last night, it was noted that Waves Magazine is no longer in print.
I think the
magazine that's actually on shelves right now is going to be their last mag. So yeah, they will be no more. Australian surf publication, Waves Mag, which was an offshoot of Tracks Mag.
Yeah, it was a Tracks thing, yeah.
And I think they started in the 70s, so they've been around a long time.
Yeah.
Kind of geared for the youth.
That makes sense. The print sort of, you know, I mean, Trans World's gone, Waves is gone.
So let me ask you, is print, or how long until print is officially dead? Speaking to a man who comes from a little bit of a print background.
I don't know. That's a good question. You know,
I
don't think that print will ever be dead, but that sounds awfully archaic for some reason, you know. But I guess it's a matter of technology. How good is technology going to get?
I don't know. I think as many magazines that have gone away in the recent years, that many have come too. Like, we now have Later Magazine, we have Monster Children Magazine, which are both surfing publications that are geared towards the youth and actually really great publications.
You know, those aren't really surf magazines, I don't think.
I think those
are youth lifestyle magazines, aren't
with
they?
A heavy focus on surfing, though.
Well, maybe.
And maybe that's the new direction.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, that's really what that does is it speaks to the so-called surf industry, which isn't really based around surfing. It's based around youth lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that actually is a bigger problem for the ASP, you know, because if the ASP thinks that all of Quicksilver's eggs are in the surfing basket, they're wrong, you know.
Right.
And same with Ruka and Billabong and all of the companies now. I mean, Vans is a great example. Vans is arguably and probably is, in fact, the largest quote-unquote surf company in the world, mm-hmm. as far as like net revenues or whatever. They're killing it. You know, like, they're making tons of money, more money than anybody. And, you know, how do they make money? They sell tennis shoes.
Right.
How many tennis shoes do you need to surf? None. Zero. 0.0, like Blukowski's grade point average. But to Vans' credit, they're putting a lot of energy into surf. But if you look at the bottom line of Vans, if they lost their surf division, they'd still be killing it.
Right.
And they realize that, you know, my wife and my son buys my wife probably buys
10 to 12 pairs of Vans a year, maybe more. And Vans kills
speak
it.
Of, speak know? Of the devil, huh?
Yeah, like she's just now coming back from the store. She's got Vans in her hand. You know what I mean? Like my son goes through Vans. But, you know, so that's a problem for the ASP. You know, like they need to realize that these surf companies aren't necessarily surf companies anymore. They're youth lifestyle companies. They're heavily into skating, heavily into snowboarding, heavily into social media and digital and making films and art and playing guitar and all of this stuff. And the day of the cut and dried surf company is long gone.
Yeah, I agree. We've talked a lot of business this show. Can I throw back to a personal surfing experience real quick?
Yeah.
In reference to... talking about Jason Bort's blog last week, how surfing ruined my life.
Yes.
Or 2 weeks ago, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And you were kind of bummed out on surfing. I've been kind of hyped on surfing. And the very next, I was thinking about that conversation we had about his blog. And it's like so much obsession about surfing that he decided to give it up for a year and just abandon it completely because it was dominating his life.
Yeah.
And I was taking the stance of like, no, man, I try to have balance in my life and try to surf a bit, but also make sure to spend time with the family and also make sure to work and make sure to do these run and do these other physical activities. So it's not all surf all the time. So the next day, the next couple days, we had waves after we did that show. And I remember I surfed 5 sessions in 2 days and I rode 3 different surfboards among those days. Just had a blast, like had tons of fun. Surf for this 48 hours, you know? And then the following day, it was a Sunday, and I was like, I'm going to spend time with my wife, go to breakfast, go to church, maybe do some lunch stuff, like just not surf at all. The waves were still good that day. I found myself at 10 a.m. at church, checking my phone, seeing other people post Instagrams about how good the waves were. And even though I had just surfed my brains out for 48 hours, I was pissed that I wasn't at the beach on that third day.
Just think how Jason Bort feels.
Exactly. And I was like... So it's easy to, I am trying to have this kind of more higher evolved approach of like, no, I'm going to live my life in balance. Surfed a few days, got it out of my system. Now I'm going to enjoy this other part of my life. Easier said than done. Because once I tried to enjoy that other part of my life, I was miserable. And my wife probably wished I would have went surfing instead of went to breakfast pissed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's tough. Finding that balance is easier said than done. And it's a... continuous struggle.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, Jason's progress through the coming year here.
It'll yeah. Be, it'll have be you kept up to date with the blog?
I haven't looked at it lately, but I do need to go. I'm friends with him on Facebook, so I get to see a lot of the stuff that he posts up, and I need to go check out the recent stuff.
Okay, yeah. The one that I read about him was just that he had cheated yesterday.
No way.
Yeah.
He cheated already?
Well, then you read the whole thing, and spoiler alert, it's just that he went to the beach and started mind surfing.
Oh.
So he's at the park with his kid looking at the waves.
Oh, I read that one.
Yeah, I read that one. So the title is that he cheated, but it was just a fantasy in his mind of cheating.
Ah.
So Duke and Kook, shall we?
Yeah, I don't really have one, but I mean, I could wing it.
No, I got a Duke for you.
All right. Duke Kahanamoku, a guy that we look up to, a person this week that Dave Scales looks up to.
Yeah, and this relates to your buddy's story that started off this episode of kind of a harrowing ocean experience.
Yeah.
2 days ago, there was a giant swell at Piahi, Jaws, in Maui.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes.
So a lot of big wave surfing went down.
Did you see the boat?
Well, I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
Yeah, do you want to explain it real quick?
No, go ahead. I don't want to.
So 2 days ago... Dej O'Connell, which is a upcoming Maui surfer who does amazing airs. He's done fairly well competitively on the QS, but also is a big wave surfer. He caught the wave of the day, and it basically had this giant step in it. So he's paddling into it. There's a bit of wind on the face. Hits this huge step in the middle of the face of the wave. Lands this kind of free fall adjustment after the step, but the wave breaks behind him. And he wipes out on it. His blow-up vest, which is supposed to inflate and save you if you're held underwater for too long, actually popped underwater. So that's the first method of saving his life. That blows up. So that's out the window. He lost his board. Actually, his leash broke. But before he lost his board, it hit him in the leg and cut him severely in 2 different spots. So he has 2 huge gashes on his leg. The board disappears. On that same wave, that he wiped out on, it washes into the channel and flips a boat, which you were alluding to because this is all caught on video, of course, and it's on YouTube. We'll post the video on our websites. But basically, this boat flips over in the channel. So all the rescue teams are now busy cleaning up that disaster. Dej finally comes up from his wipeout. He has these huge gashes on his legs. His boards are gone. His inflatable vest is popped. So he gets washed in towards the rocks. He's fighting for survival. Before he gets washed into the rocks, thankfully, one of the two rescue skis is able to swoop in and rescue him. And he's pulled to safety and he survives. And even the guy driving the jet ski said, like, Dej never once complained or said, "Hey man, where were you guys? I almost died." He was just all smiles, like thrilled to be rescued. The Instagram I saw, he posted an Instagram of his open wounds in the hospital. And then Albie Layer, another surfer from Maui, posted an Instagram of Dej in the hospital bed, giving a thumbs up, just like, "Hey man, all is good. We survived. Everybody did their job out there. I was prepared enough to survive the situation and do my job until they rescued me. And even though a couple of things went wrong, all good." So, Duke of the Week, Dej O'Connell.
Cool. Wow, interesting stuff, you know. And, yeah, we'll post the video of the boat.
And the wipeout.
I understand that the guy that was the captain of that boat was a bit of a knucklehead.
Oh, he easily could have dodged that.
I think there might have been some alcohol involved. I don't want to... this is just what I heard through the grapevine.
Okay.
That you know, he was just sort of in... out of his element, I guess I should say.
Well, all the other boats in the channel and skis and surfers who were sitting on their boards, when that wave broke, they all paddled into the channel because they could anticipate the whitewash coming. And that boat didn't. You know, that boat just got mowed down by the whitewash and it flipped over on its side. So that's a huge loss.
Yeah, I got a text from somebody that was in the water when it happened and he said that this guy was being a nightmare the whole time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So what was the aftermath of that boat?
I don't know. They were all okay. Nobody got hurt or injured. I don't know. They must have flipped it back over and, you know, got it towed back or something. I don't really know. I just, again, I got a text.
Okay.
From somebody that said, yeah.
Okay.
Guy was a nightmare.
Well, I got a kook of the week as well. Anybody who buys a Louis Vuitton surfboard, which is priced at $10,600 US.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
Louis Vuitton for 10 grand.
Louis Vuitton is now in the surfboard
game. They must be capitalizing on Beyonce and that new hit single she has. Doesn't she have a song about a surfboard or something?
She does. Yeah, I've never heard it, but I've seen people talking about it.
Yeah, me too. I've never heard it, but I've seen people talk. So maybe that's what the Louis Vuitton angle is.
Louis Vuitton surfboard. I don't know who shaped it. It looks like, I mean, a normal surfboard, but anybody who spends $10,000 on a Louis Vuitton surfboard is a kook, in my mind, kook of the week, because that $10,000 to your local shaper would be, I mean, honestly, local shapers hardly can eke out a living. We all know that. Shapers worldwide do it for the love, and they are among the most talented craftsmen out there, and they barely eke out a living, so... Donate that $10,000. Don't donate it to him, but go spend $10,000 with your local shaper buying a board from him.
Buy a bunch of boards.
Because it's that 10 grand going to Louis Vuitton's bottom line doesn't benefit the surf industry.
You know, great point, and I appreciate you pointing out that. And I know all the surfers and the craftsmen in the surf world do too. Backing up a little bit, I forgot to mention, I did get a call from my contacts in Tahiti. I spoke with my guy in Tahiti last week. And his regarding the ASP and the Billabong event at Chopu, he was saying, "Look, the Tahitian Surf Federation has not heard a peep from the ASP. They're all expecting to be, you know, hired like they're always hired, and you know, the beach marshals and the scaffolding and the whole setup is run through the Tahitian Surfing Federation, and nobody in Tahiti has heard anything from the ASP regarding the Billabong event." And I'll just leave it at that. You know, I know that the ASP is probably, you know, running on fumes right now, trying to get every event up and running. And let's wait and see where that takes us, because that's rather interesting that, you know, I'm getting a call from my guy in Tahiti who's very well connected and saying, "Hey, you know, do you know anything about this?" He listens to the show, by the way, and so he knows that we're talking heavily about the ASP, the new ASP. So it'll be interesting to see how the Tahitian event plays out. The politics there are deep, and they're more
They're deeper than you may realize regarding the players that we all know in Tahiti. You know, it's interesting. So,
and that event's in May, right?
I think it is, yeah.
So that's a mere 2 months away.
Yeah, nobody in Tahiti's even heard from the ASP.
That's scary.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about waiting till last minute. The ASP waited till last minute to reveal the schedule at large, and then even when they announced that Karamas was on it, that changed, you know, a month into the season or a couple weeks into the season, and they replaced it with Jay Bay. So, yeah, I mean, those guys really wait until the last minute to reveal what's going on.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. I mean, there's so much politics in each geographic region. Right now, the guys at the ASP are just trying to come through Australia and deal with the egos there. Then there's politics everywhere, so it's just really, really interesting how this year is going to unfold and all the stuff that's going to be thrown at the ASP. I tell you, I'm glad I'm not in their shoes.
And but a real lack of transparency on their part, which I think is making everybody more nervous.
Well, yeah. And there's been some great articles in the Australian media about the guys that own the ASP. You know, have you read about this Ziff guy, last name Ziff?
He's the investor, basically.
Yeah, he's the money. His wife is the money behind this. Well, his wife just got, a fancy towards women surfing and said, honey, let's invest in this thing. And like all the pieces fell into. And so some multi-billionaire guy in Florida owns the ASP, basically, along with, you know, four or five others.
Do you know anything about his background? Like,
he seems like a good guy. That, you know, he's born into money. His dad, you know, it's if you Google it, just Wikipedia Ziff, you know, I don't know his first name, but
yeah.
I was reading about him, Tim Baker or somebody, maybe it was Sean Doherty, somebody in Australia wrote a great article about him. And, you know, he's got a lot of money, and his wife wanted to buy the Pro Tour, and so they did.
Yeah, interesting.
We should get some more information
for
our listeners on this next time.
Yeah, we will. We
so
will, for
will
sure.
You remind me to get some background on
Absolutely.
This Ziff character that is the main money man behind the ASP?
I will. All right, Scott.
All right. Long show. Thanks for bearing with us. We hope we were entertaining. We hope we were informative. We hope we were insightful.
Yeah, thanks for listening. I'm going to post one other thing real quickly about surfboards. I mentioned Louis Vuitton. Mercedes-Benz actually designed a surfboard, co-designed it with Garrett McNamara. Did you see that?
I did see that.
Yeah, so I don't need to talk at length about it, but I'll post the video to that of Garrett McNamara riding the Mercedes-Benz surfboard in Portugal at the Big Wave Spot, whose name we never know how to pronounce, Nazare, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
So I'll post that video too. But again, all the media that we talked about in this episode, video, photos, links to websites, can all be found on my website, surfsplendorpodcast.com, and then also on Scott's website.
Yeah, downthelineradio.com. You can find all of the stuff that we've been discussing there.
And you can also leave comments on those pages about this show. Just join in the conversation. And also on social media, I'm at Surf Splendor is the Instagram and Twitter, and then Facebook.com/Surf Splendor.
Did you see that?
I see that. Is that Swami's?
That's Swami's.
Are you on the ASIM right there?
That's Big Saturday.
Are you on that Carl Ekstrom?
No, that's a Bing. That's a 6'4" Bing.
Man, that is an amazing wave. Scott, you should post that photo.
Oh, man, my ego is going through the roof right now.
It's your new Facebook profile pic. It's Scott Scott dropping in on like a double overhead right at Swami's. Almost like a free fall drop.
It was. It was the
crazy
greatest drop of my life.
Awesome, man.
Hey, until next week, thanks so much for listening to David and I. Adios and aloha. Take my arm and walk me in. And that's what's happening this week in Surf News. Thank you, Scott Bass, for helping co-host the show. Thank you, Johnny Kessel, for sharing your amazing story. We're thrilled that you made it back to shore, and can't wait to see you in the lineup next time. Thanks to all the listeners of Surf Splendor. As you're probably well aware by hearing me say it repeatedly, all past shows are archived for free at surfsplendorpodcast.com or in iTunes or Stitcher. If you listen in one of those two apps, please make sure to rate the show if you haven't already and leave a review to help other future listeners find our show. Also, you can follow us
on social media at Surf Splendor, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Also, make sure to share the show with a friend. I always ask for that, but honestly, that is the best form of advertising. That's our only form of advertising, but it's organic and it's truthful. And if you like the show and you want to hear more episodes in the future, that is your little investment into our show, is simply to share it with a friend. And until next time, this is David Scales signing off and saying aloha.